Okay, Erev Tov. Good evening. We're just coming to the finale. We're finishing the Book of Ruth. What has been so difficult, firstly I want to sort of, before I even talk about the difficulty, I want to express Hakaras HaTov. The fact is that although I've learned this a number of times, being made to teach it is one of the best ways of actually learning it really sort of the way one should. And I'm very grateful for that, because this is such an amazing story and so many twists and turns and nuances which I'd never come across before. So I hope I managed to convey some of that. It's very hard to put over so much of the material. In other words, there's more material that I had to leave out than I could put in, because there is so much to talk about. But saying that, I think we've had a pretty good shot at trying to get to the heart, to the source of this safe. Not quite. you're pushing. One day, maybe. We'll never know. You never know. The story in chapter 4 is very much the sort of the flip side of what we saw last week, where we know that Naomi pushed the envelope as far as she could to get Ruth to, inspire Boaz to do something about their situation. And Naomi obviously understands also, that Chazal say prophetically, Boaz and Ruth have to consummate the marriage and produce a child. And this child was going to be the continuation of the messianic enterprise, the messianic line, which starts already in the Torah and continues right through to King David and beyond. So with that kind of thought in mind, we'll have a look at chapter 4. There's two issues that I really want to deal with today. Good evening. In terms of the beginning of Perek Daled, which is probably one of the most non-understandable pieces of the story. You know, I certainly did not understand it well till I sort of put my mind to it a bit and tried to come to terms with what's going on. The problem is like this, and I'll just explain it again. We spoke about it last week, that there is a practice which is known as Geula. Geula is redemption. We read about this week's parasha and Parsha Bahar a bit, the idea of redeeming the property, the family property, which gets sold. You have a certain amount of time to buy it back. But here we're talking about something which is an extra practice, and it's not included in the law of the Torah that we're going to read about this week, but it's added on. And the idea is that not only do you redeem the land, which is family land, but together with the land, there's an obligation of marrying whoever's connected to the land. So in this case, for instance, what we seem to have done is rolled two things into one. It's kind of a yibum situation. Yibum, again, is this law when the two brothers, one is married, one isn't, and Nebuch, the first husband, dies. The second brother has an obligation either to marry the widow, or to do what is called chalitza and to break the relationship. And this is the law of the Torah, which we know as yibum, and it's a law which requires the brother to make a commitment, either to marry the sister-in-law, the widow, or not to marry. And that's the law where we require a marriage to take place, or a disconnect to take place. But here we're talking about a relative also having, not just a brother, in other words. This could be, in this case, it's as far as Ruth is concerned, through marriage, it's someone from the previous generation, it's one of Naomi's contemporaries, who is going to be required to marry her. Now, this is something which, again, the Ramban, we saw the comment of the Ramban, that this doesn't happen. Certainly, it's not something that we practice today. But nevertheless, this is part of the story. It's very similar to the ideas of what we call, in this week's parsha, we have it, Go'al et Amimkar, Geula, and at the same time, it's also got elements of Yibum, of the what is called in English, the Levirate marriage. It's got elements of that as well. Now, what is so fascinating in chapter 4 is the negotiation. Okay, as with all good Jewish deals, we've got to have a bit of negotiation before we actually sit down. This is the Middle East, after all. You've got to litvaker, you've got to have a bit of an argument about it. So let's see what happened here. Dalet, chapter 4, I'm not sure what page you're actually in your book. 92. So listen to this. Two issues I want to deal with. Number one is the fact that Boaz seems to be doing this very, very quickly. In other words, from one day to the next, Boaz is already at the Bet Din trying to facilitate the whole situation. And number two, which we're going to read about in a minute, is the reluctance of the close relative known as Ploni Almoni. We're not even told his name. We know his name is Tov. But he's called here Mr. Anonymous. And the reason why he's so reluctant to actually carry out the obligation which Boaz spells out for him so clearly. So two issues that I want to deal with in this part of the story. And, you know, maybe we'll end with a few comments, again, sort of just ideas of things to follow up. So have a look at this, chapter 4. Well, Boaz ala hashar. Boaz goes up to the gate. Now, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, would be meeting at the gate of the city. That's why the Gemaras are known as Bovas, right? Bova Kama, Bova Batra, the gate. Because those are sections of Talmud which deal between man and man. Arguments that may eventually go to Sanhedrin or go to Bet Din, and that's where they used to sit. They used to sit at the gate of the city, the entrance. So Boaz goes to the Shah, to the gate of the town, Vayeshev Shom, presumably Beit Lechem, and he sits there, right? And he's there very early in the morning. Vehineha Goel Oven. It's as if he's there before the other guy, this guy who's meant to come and redeem the land and marry Ruth, has turned up, and Boaz is already there. And the Goel, this Redeemer, is passing by, Asher Dibeh Boaz, with whom Boaz had, spoken about, I suppose you would say in this case. Vayomer Surush Vana Ploni Almoni, and he tells him, Kimeher, come here, Boena, Ploni Almoni, come here. And of course, he calls him Ploni Almoni. And the rabbis say, Ploni Almoni actually means, Ploni means from Lashon Mafli, the idea of something which is amazing. But in the sense of hidden, like a nace, a pella. All right? He's hidden, and Almoni is Lashon Ilem. Ilem means he's deaf, he can't hear. And he doesn't listen to the words of the rabbis, as you'll see in a minute. So it's not a very great title to be called Ploni Almoni. But whatever it is, he says to him, Shvopo Ploni Almoni, Ploni Almoni, sit here. V'yosar v'yeshev. So Ploni Almoni seems to be going in the opposite direction. And he turns around and he sits down. So, again, the question really is, why is Boaz there so early at the crack of dawn, before Ploni Almoni turns up? And we'll deal with that in a minute. I just want to show you a bit of the story. What does Boaz do? Vayikach asara nashim, has a minion. Now, you'll say to me, all right, he's got a daven shachris, but, you know, this is not just a minion for shachris. There's a whole discussion about why he has these 10 men with him. Miziknei ha'ir, from the elders of the city. We're always talking in the Gemara about asara batlanim, the 10 idol people in the community. Maybe this is where it comes from. The 10 guys who are sitting around, and, you know, you've always got a minion, you've always got a group in hand. And also he said to them, sit here, and they sat. And therefore, what happens, in fact, is Boaz constitutes a group of people, a minyan, and the Gemara actually explains for two reasons. Number one, that if he ends up marrying Ruth, he wants to do the wedding straight away. All right, and then he will have what we call Sheva Brachot. There's a whole Gemara about this, Gemara Ketubot. And for Sheva Brachot, you need a minion. All right, you need 10 men to say the Sheva Brachot at a wedding. Fine. That's a kind of very, wishful thinking interpretation. The other interpretation which is suggested is that the 10 people will act as spokesmen. They will repeat and become the people who transmit the message from Boaz. What is the message that has to be transmitted? It's back to what we've seen all the way through. That Boaz has already, through his court, and he's now reinstating, or going back to that particular decision, and this is the explanation given why it's so early in the morning, Boaz is reinstating the law that the exclusion of Moabites only applies to men not becoming Jewish, but it doesn't apply to women. Moavi velo Moavit. And this is being now reenacted or reinstated in front of Asara Anashim, 10 men. And the suggestion is that these 10 men can then go and spread the word wherever you want it to go. Viziknei ha'ir, from the elders of the city, and they're obviously sort of men who understand the implication of all of this. And it's interesting. Let me give you this page and I'll show you a bit more common about this, because this is very fascinating. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the person who wrote these comments. I'm not going to do the whole thing, so you don't have to get too worried about it. I don't want to send it around. Yeah.
Isn't the Sanhedrin...
Yeah, now this is a good question, and I'm going to answer that question in a minute. All right? The answer is that it's not quite as simple as that. Okay? We're going to talk about that in a second. What I want to show you is section B. Section B, I haven't ignored your question. I'm going to come back to it. Okay? Because that's going to be in the next comment. Section B is a piece that I found from somebody called Reuven Margolius. Reuven Margolius was an amazing individual. He only passed away, I think, in the last 30 years. He was an Illui, absolutely brilliant person. His books have been reprinted. He wrote over 150 Sfarim, this man. He was a genius. Lived in Eretz Yisrael for most of his life, I think originally from Europe. was very much to the in the Tzioni world. He was very much pro-Zionist in many, many ways. And a lot of his books have been reprinted by the Mossad Rav Kook, which is one of the sort of major printing houses in Yerushalayim. And unbelievable. This man is really on the ball. Very unusual gentleman, thank you. Has written commentary on Talmud, has written works of academic interest, you know, sort of more archaeological stuff. He was a genius in everything. Not very well known. I had to look him up, had to find out who he was. But this piece that he has over here in section B is fascinating. And I'll just read it to you very quickly, and then we'll finish the chapter. Voto yom nitchad shalacha, the section B. On the right-hand side, the very day that this whole event takes place with Boaz and the Ploni Almoni, it's the day when the law has been renewed. Because Signon Chachamenim, Shachum v'Chazav Yastum. What happened was, it was a law which did exist. It was forgotten. It wasn't practiced, and it became re-established. What does that mean? Nitchadsha v'nitparsama lacha al yidei Boaz. That Boaz made this law well known. But Re'eg Ketubot Zayinam Aved, as I told you, the Gemara in Ketubot, page 7. Vayikach Asara Nashim Mizikney. Got a few extra ones over here. You got a page. Again, as it says, he took Asara Nashim Mizikney Hador, 10 men. Third line. Kedei Lemidrash Amoni Velo Amonit Moavi Velo Moavit, to exclude the women from the prohibition of becoming Jewish. The Moabite women can become Jewish. If you think, in other words, the Gemara's got a whole discussion. If you need 10 people just for Sheva Brachas, why get Zakenim? Get anybody. So the fact that you have elders, the Gemara says, is more, not just that they should be a minion to do Sheva Brachas when the wedding takes place, but even more than that, they will be able to explain the new law. Now, next paragraph. V'hinei, yodua ki talmid chacham shemorei alacha, shomim lo. Usually, if a scholar announces a law, you listen. Rak kishiyore terem shetavo ma'asel yodo. He will give the decision before the actuality takes place. In other words, if Boaz had come along a day later and said that Moabite is allowed after he'd already married Ruth, that's, as you say, that's closing the door, the stable door, after the horse has bolted. I don't know if you say that in this country. You probably do. Yeah. It's an expression from the old country. But I suppose it's here as well. And what it basically means is that it's too late. You know, it's almost as if you'll be accused of creating the halacha for your own purpose. So what does Boaz do over here? Before the Ploni Almoni even sort of turns up, Boaz has already got these 10 guys together, and he's basically convened a halachic court, and he's made an announcement that this decision about the Moabite lady is now to be confirmed. And those 10 men will then go and spread the word throughout the Jewish world. And look at this, the second line of the second paragraph.
Rabbi,
yeah.
If the whole Indian is about Hebrew, does Hebrew take place if the woman isn't already Jewish?
Yeah, the point is that at this point she's definitely Jewish, by this juncture. There's no question about it. Because there are still people who are not accepting her status. You'll see in a minute. It's on Elliot's question, the same thing. There is going to be a very serious question mark on Ruth, not only while she was alive, but even after she died, as to whether she is to be included to be counted as Jewish. And that is really one of the key issues in the whole book. And what Boaz is trying to do here is to make it like, you know, public knowledge that everyone will be on the same page to accept the fact that she is now able to convert and become Jewish and accepted as Jewish. She can convert, she can go and dunk in the mikveh, but if it's not going to be accepted, it's a waste of time. Whatever she's done till now may very well be rejected. So what's going on over here is that Boaz is trying to make it known, the halakha, before the events take place in chapter 4. That's why it's all happening so early in the morning. He's getting the minyan together to make the announcement that the Moabite woman is allowed. And then they're going to have this whole discussion with the Ploni Almoni as to what then will happen in terms of this land and marrying Ruth at the same time. But once you've established her credential as being accepted in the Jewish people, then the next stage of the process is able to take place. If you don't accept that credential, then you can't go to the next stage. So you'll have the land, but what's going to happen to Ruth? And it's all about not just getting the land, but it's getting the name of the family to continue through the next generation. Ruth will be marrying Boaz. They'll have a son which will be attributed to that family, and it will continue on through the generation. But in order to achieve that, you need two components. You need someone to redeem the land and someone to marry Ruth. And marrying Ruth is something which you have to prepare for by establishing that Ruth can be married. Now, Ploni Almoni doesn't get it. This guy doesn't get it.
But he's establishing that she's Jewish.
He's establishing that she can be converted and that she's Jewish, yeah.
That she was converted.
Right.
Not that she's going to be converted.
Right. Right, right. And according to most...
Technically, her sister is also Jewish.
Correct, correct. And that's one of the big challenges, of course, that what happens afterwards in terms of David and Goliath, because Goliath is the grandson of Orpah, so Goliath could have been not quite a nice Jewish boy, not quite, but that's part of the follow-up. By Jewish blood, yeah, yeah. And it's very challenging, this whole thing. As I said, this is part of the story, which it does get kind of complicated. But I wanted to show you this, because I just want to finish a few more lines of this and go back to the text, to the main text. But have a look at this, the third line. Second line, excuse me. We want to make sure that Boaz does not seem to be biased. So what do? Boaz hen haya bismano Rosh Sanhedrin. We know that Boaz was the head of the Sanhedrin after the bracket. Boaz ubeit dino hitkinu lishol shalom b'shem. We saw that previously, that he made a halacha to ask everybody in the name of God. What? How are you? B'shem Hashem. And that's something that they instituted. L'chein b'sha'a sheba l'shevet b'rosh sod chachamim l'frasem et ha'kabbalah. So now that they're getting together to announce this renewal of the law, which has been established but is now to be rekindled about the Moabite woman on the next column, it was only known to individuals but not to the whole generation. It applies to the men and not to the women. The prohibition, in other words, women can be the Moabite women can become Jewish. It was necessary. Shehu ba'atzmo lo yonogeh b'davar. That Boaz has to be seen to be impartial. Klomar terem she mi'ein almoni ligo. Before the other guy says, "I don't want to redeem, I don't want to marry her," Boaz has got to be seen to be doing whatever he's doing before the other guy says no. Lachain is dareis Boaz. Third line. Va'Allah hashal ifnei. So Boaz goes there early, before the girl arrives, before the other guy arrives. Ploni Almoni's not there yet. Lishol oto im hurotze, to be ready to ask him, do you want to marry her? Ligol ol ma'en, do you want to do it, or you refuse? B'choshvo ulay yima'en agol, because maybe he'll refuse. V'az yehu Boaz noger b'davar. And if Boaz hasn't set this up already, then he'll be accused of being biased, because, you know, he obviously wants to step in. So basically, what we're saying is that Boaz is smart. He doesn't want to have any accusation that he cooked the books over here. So what does he want to do? He initially turns up early in the morning in front of this group of Zakenim, who are clearly Zakenim in the sense of learned men. And he says to them, there is a law which I want to make sure is absolutely made clear to the Jewish people, and there's something which is obviously very applicable to what's going to happen today, but I want to make it absolutely well known that the Moabite woman can become Jewish. And then when the goel comes along, Boaz says, come here, come in, I want to talk to you. And then they start the whole discussion about whether to redeem the land and then eventually to marry Ruth. Now that's looking at it from the side of Boaz. Boaz is trying to show himself to be impartial because he wants Ruth, the status, to be kosher so that the goel, the redeemer, will marry her. If he wants to do it, he can go ahead and do it. You know, Boaz is not sort of reserving her for himself. If the other guy wants to marry her, he's now perfectly capable of doing so because her status has been established by this group of 10 men as being acceptable. The Ploni Almoni, that's a different story. He doesn't see it like that. I just wanted to show you this because it's so interesting how these events really do fit together so carefully. If you go back to chapter 4, and I'm not going to do more of this, but this is Rav Margolius. He's a very, very interesting writer. If you ever get to see some of his stuff, he's got this, I don't know, interesting book. So I wanted you to sort of get to know the name anyway. But go back to the text, the original text that we're reading. Again, I'm just going to start from chapter 4 again to show you how it works. Aleph. Ubaz ala shava yeshev sham. So Boaz got there early in the morning. And it's before everybody is there. V'inei goel over asher dibei Boaz v'yom esur shvapo ploni almoni v'asa v'yeshev. And that's when the ploni almoni turns up. V'yikach asar anashim. Now, Margolis says that what happened was Boaz had already taken 10 men, mizikneh ha'ir, and their elders, meaning that they're knowledgeable, and he'd already sat them down, and they had already decided to announce that the Moabite woman is going to be acceptable. All of this is before the following verse 3 in the negotiation. Gimel. And at this point, Boaz says to the goel, to this gentleman, the Ploni Almoni, Chelkata sadeh she'elachinu le'elimelech. There is a portion of land belonging to Elimelech, Machra Naomi Hashava Mistei Moab, which Naomi sold. Either she had already sold it, or she's prepared to, has to sell it, or had to sell it rather, you know, from the old days. And we want to get it back. And I am now saying that I have to tell you the following. I literally will open your ears. And I'm telling you, Kenei, that it has to be bought back. Neged Yoshvim, in front of the people who are sitting here. Neged Ziknei Ami, in front of the elders of my people. Im Tigal Gaol, it gives him a choice. If you, Ploni Almoni, want to redeem the land, go ahead and do so. Vim Lo Yigal Hagidoli, if you don't want to do so, tell me. Veidah, and then I will know. Ki Ein Zulatcha Ligol, that you don't want to do it. Vanochi Acharecha, and I'm next in line. Vayomer, so what did Ploni say? The guy called Tov. Anochi Egal, he said, it's a great deal. Getting this land, obviously he probably got it for a good price and whatever. So far, he's very happy. He's come, you know, he went out for his morning constitutional, taking the dog for a walk. The next thing you know, he's involved in some sort of deal where he's getting a nice piece of land. He's a happy man. However, says Boaz at this point, Vayomer Boaz. Biyom, here comes the small print, right? Vayomer Boaz. Biyom k'notcha sadeh miyad Naomi. On the day that you buy this field from Naomi, in other words, you redeem it, me'et ruta movia, eshet ha'meit, kanita, and it says kaniti, because obviously Boaz is really wants himself to buy it, but it's written and read in two different ways. Kanita is the way you read it. In other words, if you buy it from Naomi and Ruth the Moabite, and he's stressing movia, that you should know, you know, that this is all part of what we've been discussing today, who was the wife of the dead person. Then, lahakim shema meta nachlato, you have to establish the name of the dead person over his portion. In other words, basically, what Boaz is saying, you can have the land, but you've got to take Ruth with the land. Right? And it's ruta moaviyah, just to stress that we, and of course, it's, according to what we learned just now, it's to emphasize that the law is that she can, that she, in other words, when she became Jewish, she is Jewish, and you have to accept that. And the Ploni Almoni does not want to know. And it's unbelievable. Vayomer ha-goel lo uchal ligoli. He says, I can't do it. Penashchit et nachlati. Because I'll destroy my own inheritance. If I marry her, then you know what's going to happen? Everyone's going to start sort of disassociating from me because they will consider her to be Moabite. They won't want to have anything to do with me. So I'm throwing away my whole future by marrying her. Ga'al l'cha'ata et gulati. He says, you do the redemption. You know, you're the Shabbos goy, right? You do it. Ki lo chaligo, because I am unable to do it. He's a nice guy, right? This is a friendly sort of guy. This is all family business. And the girl says, I'm not going to do it. So, of course, the question is, what is going on here? You know, on the one hand, Boaz has announced, and the 10 men have announced that the law is that Moabite is allowed, the woman. So Ruth is kosher. Now that this girl comes along, this other gentleman, who is the brother of Elimelech, and he says, I can't marry her. I can't do it. And he rejects it, and he says that I will not only by marrying Ruth, I'm going to destroy my whole future. So wait a minute, what's going on here? Doesn't the girl realize that it's just been announced in Beth Din that in fact Ruth is kosher, so of course you can marry her. What do you mean you're destroying your future? Doesn't make sense. And all the commentaries here seem to be sort of, you know, sort of, as they say in Yiddish, nishtahim, nishtaher. It's very difficult to understand what's going on. Why does this guy, who seems to, on the one hand, want to redeem, and then when he's told he has to marry Ruth, says no, but at the same time, it's just after the announcement, again, that Ruth is kosher. What is wrong with marrying Ruth? That is the question, really, the second question I wanted to deal with. First question, as I said, why Boaz was there so early in the morning? I wanted to make that clear. Now, the second question, which I hope is equally as challenging, is why is the goel so reluctant when he's told it's Ruth? And for that, I just have to share with you, I didn't get a chance to photocopy, I saw it today. And I'll share this with you, and this, it was worth coming this evening just to hear this. It's unbelievable. Reb Soloveitchik from YU, on the other end of the family, the anti-Zionist end of the family, there was a whole bunch of Soloveitchiks, and the famous one, Reb Velva Soloveitchik, who after, in 1940, managed to escape from Warsaw. I don't know, there's a lot of stories about it. He eventually got to Eretz Yisrael and died in 1958. And he wrote these comments, didn't write them. The Soloveitchik tradition was not only the Rav in YU and Yeshiva, but also throughout the Soloveitchik family, probably coming from Reb Chaim, from the grandfather, never to write down what they said. They basically said it, and it was verbatim. And the students sort of wrote it down as a, you know, they obviously tried to write down as best they could, but the Rebbe never wrote it down. But in this case, it's so interesting. They recorded the following analysis. Because he asked this question, he says, I don't understand. If Ploni Almoni is allowed to marry Ruth, according to Boaz's decision, then why now is he making such a fuss? So he says, I have to explain this to you, and this is so fundamental. He says like this, he says that there are in fact two ways of deciding Jewish law. And this may come as a bit of a surprise, but it's worth hearing. He says the first way of deciding Jewish law is through a Sanhedrin, through a Bet Din. What happens is that the Bet Din comes along and makes a decision, as they have done in Jewish history, through different periods. There were periods, one example that springs to mind is the whole thing of Chol of Yisrael was a problem at a certain time, and that's why the decision was made to insist that the milk has to be supervised, because you might have milk from trefa animals. That's why when Rav Moshe Feinstein came along and could change it around, different Bote Din, different points of view. And as generally what has happened is that these laws are decided or are brought to our attention by a process which is known as Yud Gimel Midot. When you want to try and extend or to establish, particularly rabbinic law, basing yourself on a Torah precedent or a word or a hint in the Torah, you go to the 13, what is called, rules of hermeneutics. That's what it's called in English. Well, we say it every day. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Shlosha Esrei Midot. 13 ways of expounding the Torah. There is another section, another brisa, which is found in the Gemara, which says it's 32 ways of expounding the Torah. So they're all different ways of doing it. And these methods are used from one Bet Din to the next Bet Din, and of course what can happen is, one Bet Din can establish a law, and then the next Bet Din can come along and say, in a later generation, we want to change the law. So how do they change the law? By coming along and saying that we expound the whole thing differently, we explain it differently. But of course, the rabbi said that will create chaos, because what will happen is, it'll be on and off, on and off. Well, how are you going to decide what to do? So the rabbis made a rule that the Bet Din, which establishes the law, if a new Bet Din wants to change it, they have to be greater in wisdom and in number, meaning that basically they've got to be you know, sort of higher caliber. Whatever, how you decide that, of course, is very difficult. But that's the decision. So what has happened essentially for us is that laws which have been established, it's almost impossible to change. We can vary, we can slightly nuance them, but to remove them is almost impossible till we get to a Bet Din or Sanhedrin situation all over again, and then maybe we can sort of, you know, start the process. But all of this is negotiable. All of this is where once upon a time you would have a law which was established, and then a next generation, a new group would come along, a new Bet Din, and they could change it. If they were greater in number or in wisdom, they could change it. So what happens over here, of course, is the following. There is a second method of establishing Jewish law. And the second method is known as Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. If you can prove that this Halacha has been established from Moshe on Mount Sinai, he received it from God, as we said this week, Bahar Sinai, this week's parasha, then we are bound by that law regardless of whoever wants to change it. It's unchangeable. That is a separate style of halakha, which is the Gemara very often tries to establish halakha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. The Gemara talks about it a lot, because once it becomes halakha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai, then there's no discussion. So the question is, and says Rav Velva Soloveitcher, and he says so beautifully, he says, what's going on here with Pliny Almoni? Pliny Almoni, this gentleman, thinks that this is a law of Ruth, of the Moabite, is open for negotiation. Boaz can come along in his generation and say, she's kosher. Go 20 years, 30 years down the line, there'll be a new Bet Din. What will they turn around and say? She's not kosher. They'll have a different way of explaining the Torah. And you know what? They may be right. And you know what's going to happen? That he's married, the girl, this guy will have married Ruth. And it turns out, with hindsight, she's not going to be Jewish. And we know that this was a problem because later on in the days of David, you know what happened? A guy comes along called Doeg Edomi. We learned about him in Sefer Shmuel. And he says, you know, don't worry about David and whether he's got Yichus or whatever. Find out whether he's Jewish. Doeg was prepared to argue, and it's so interesting. We spoke about it a lot. He was prepared to argue that David's not even Jewish. And this is maybe 100 years, or how should we say, whatever number of years it is later, that David's yichus is being questioned because he comes from Ruth, who may not be Jewish. But we've just said over here that Boaz has established that he is Jewish. David is Jewish because Ruth is Jewish. So make up your mind. The answer is, that's the problem with establishing halacha like this when it's done according to the rules of Bet Din. One Bet Din can say she's Jewish, the next Bet Din can come along and change the rule. Says Reb Velva, but this is not the case over here. Pliny Almoni thought it was the case, and that's why he doesn't want to marry her. Because he says, come back in 50 years' time, and he'll be alive, but you know what? They're going to start questioning whether my grandchildren are Jewish. I don't want that. Boaz was trying to say, and this comes out later on in the days of David, that this is not a law which is based on these calculations. You know what this is? It's halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. It's established from Sinai that a Moabite woman can become Jewish. If it's established from Sinai, then you know what happens? There's no discussion. It's the end of the debate because she can become Jewish, period. The trouble is, Pliny Almoni, and it says Almoni that was Elaim, as we said, he didn't listen to the words of Torah. He didn't understand that this was the way that Boaz was establishing the halacha. He was establishing it, and we see this later on in the discussion in the days of David, that Amasa ben Yeter was the head of the army. Here's Doeg complaining that David's not Jewish, and he comes into the Beit Medrash. I told you this a few weeks ago. He takes a sword, and he puts it down in the ground. He says, anyone who says that David is not Jewish, Mekublani says, I've accepted from the Bet Din of Shmuel that Moaviv alo Moavit, that the Moabite woman is kosher, and David is kosher. What's going on in that Gemara? It's so strange. And the head of the army has to do this? He's a great scholar, but he's the head of the army. The answer is yes, because he is saying, Mekublani means Kabbalah. It's a tradition going back to Moses, that Boaz was right, that Ruth can be Jewish and stays Jewish. And there's no discussion now, and a Bet Din cannot come along later and start saying, well, she's not really Jewish, and Doeg cannot come along and make his announcement that David is not Jewish. It's all batel. It's not happening. The reason is because it was established from day one that Ruth can become Jewish. But as we saw in Rav Margolius says, it wasn't well known. This was halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. People didn't know. So Boaz is trying to make sure that everybody knows. And once it gets established like this, for Boaz, it's obvious that he can marry her. But Ploni Almoni's got all of these questions because he thinks it's the other way of establishing the law. Not by saying it's a law from Mount Sinai, but he's saying it's a law which is open for discussion. Bet Din today will say she's Jewish. Bet Din tomorrow will say she's not Jewish. Ploni Almoni says, I don't want that. I'd rather not get involved with the whole problem. Boaz, you deal with it. And that, says Rav Elbert, is what's going on here. And it's so unbelievable. It's just amazing. And of course, this is typical Brisk, if you understand what I mean. There's two ways of looking at the story, two different analyses. But the way that he comes out is so interesting that, in essence, what's going on at the beginning of chapter 4 is a halachic debate. Boaz is trying to establish once and for all this halacha is halacha l'moshe misinai, period. It goes right back to the earliest days. Says Ploni Almoni, I don't know. He says, I'm not sure. As far as I'm concerned, maybe I'll be good, but what will happen in the future? Nachalati. What's going to be down the line? Maybe people will question it, as they eventually did. Because they didn't. Doeg did not get it either. Much later in Jewish history, he didn't understand it. And if this is what is going on in the background here, in the whole discussion. And that's why what Boaz says over here is so interesting and so to the point. I hope that makes sense. These two ways of fixing halakha. Very quickly, one and two. Yeah.
I used to say he wasn't interested, and Naomi knew that.
Yeah, but the language, Ashchit et Nachalati, he's saying something very extreme. I'm going to destroy my future because of marrying her. He wants to redeem the land. He's happy to take the land.
But Naomi must have known 2 chapters ago that this is going to happen.
Well, it's not sure. It could be that he will, he will sort of step in. There's no guarantees. Because it could be that, they just felt that there must be something where she understands that they've come together with Boaz for a special reason. Right? And of course, if you add in the Chazal, like we saw last week, the incredible thing about his family dying out, and the fact is that as soon as he marries her, he dies the next day, then you realize there's something really unbelievable going on here. All right? And this is the rabbinic tradition that as soon as they got married, the next day, Nebuch, Boaz dies. No, it's not clear. It's possible that there was this element of Nevuah in the minds of. In other words, let's not call it Nevuah, but some sort of inspiration. Something where they knew that this was the way it was meant to play out. That it was so unlikely. Think about it. Ruth has married Mahlon. She's married this guy in Moab. They're both young or whatever. No children. She ends up marrying Boaz. He's an 80-year-old man, right? There's a gap of like 60 years or 70 years between them. Whatever it is, 50 years. And and she conceives and that's it, and she has the child. So there's something really unbelievable going on here, right? And that's why this whole story is so interesting. And as I said, I never come to grips with this discussion, the halachic discussion. Ploni Almoni, make up your mind. What are you worried about? And just I wanted to throw that in because it's such an interesting way of looking at it that he didn't see the halacha the way that Boaz saw the halacha. And I feel that's very relevant. It's kind of an added bonus of understanding this. Yeah.
I don't know, for me it seems like Boaz tried to be some kind of politically correct.
Correct, yeah.
And the only thing is I really agree with him that he might knew all the answers already.
Yeah.
He might saw that in the Boaz and things like that. The only things that I face it, Ploni Almoni just say, you know what, I'm not doing it, you're doing it.
Yeah.
But you don't see any indication this is challenging the halacha.
Yeah. Yeah, except the language, as I'm saying, that this Lashon...
But he say, this is not right. He doesn't show any fears or whatever explanation that he is.
Yeah.
He just say, he's just washing out of his hands.
Yeah,
his hand
washing hands. Yeah.
He said, Boaz, you did it, but he doesn't challenge the halacha for
that. Yeah, that is what you have to read into the background of the whole discussion. That's behind the scenes. It's a bit like Megillat Esther. Everything you do in Megillat Esther, there's always something going on behind the scene. And with one of the great things of Megillat Rut is that there's also a lot going on behind the scenes that we just don't, information that we need to know to explain in a bit deeper. But your point's a good point. All right, I'm just throwing it in there because otherwise I'm at a loss to try and tell you why Ploni Almoni was one hand very happy and then the next minute he rejects. Very odd guy. Maybe he was an odd guy. I just don't know. Right.
And what I heard is you have to fool the Satan in some way.
That's next week's speech. Yeah, that's next week's speech. So we'll talk a bit about that next week. Because what we've done, as I said in the beginning, we went from big picture to small picture, and next week we have to go right back to the big picture. All right, at the moment, and that's all part of what we're going to talk about, Mitzvah Shem, next week. I want to finish the chapter. Listen to this. Va, all right, I'm going to just race it through here. Va. So, Zayin, excuse me. V'zod lefanim b'Yisrael ala gulal ha'tmura l'kayim kol davar shel avi shenalo. So they make a kinyan. What we now do is, you know, when you sell your chometz, the rabbi gives you his handkerchief or sometimes his watch or whatever. So in those days, they would do it with a shoe. V'natan l'rei, he gives his shoe, whoever gave the shoe to whom. There's a big discussion in the rabbinic literature, who gave the shoe. Did Boaz give it to him or he gave it to Boaz, whichever way around. V'zod atu davi Yisrael, and this becomes the established law in Israel of a transaction. Vayomer ha'goel leBoaz kneilach. So the girl says to Boaz, "You buy." Vayishlof na'alo, and he took off his shoe. So it feels as if it's probably the goel taking off his shoe, giving it to Boaz, and the transfer takes place. What we call bartering. Vayomer Boaz azakeinim v'chol ha'am edim adam hayom. So he says to everybody around, "You're witnesses. Ki kaniti et kol asher l'Avimelech v'et kol asher l'kinyan machlan. I have now acquired all of the family property miyad Naomi from Naomi. V'gamed Ruta Moviyah." This is the last time she's called Ruta Moviyah, because he's stressing, "I'm acquiring Ruth the Moabite to tell you that she's kosher, because I know she's always called Ruta Moviyah, but now she's going to be Ruth mi Beit Lechem." She's going to have a new title. Eshet Machlon kaniti li lisha lakim shem amein. Anachlatam, I'm going to establish the name of the dead person on his land, the family of Elimelech. Below you create shem amein mi'im achiv misha mekomo, and the name will not be lost from the gates of his place, from his brothers. Eidim atem ayom, your witnesses today. Vayomru kol om asher bashar vazakeinim eidim. It's like a mini Har Sinai. I always thought there was a connection there. It's like saying Nasav Nishma. They're listening and they're saying, "We are witnesses. We testify like we did at Mount Sinai." Maybe there is this kind of symbolic connection there. And they say, they give a bracha. Yitein Hashem et Aisha habal beitcha k'rachel v'leah. K'leah, may she be like Rachel and Leah. The people heard and they understood the tzibah, at least they judged Boaz, the kav zechut, that what he was doing was kosher, and that this woman was now giving a bracha. She should become like Rachel and Leah, even though Leah was the great grandmother of these people. But Rachel, they're not coming from Rachel's side, but they put Rachel first because biblically we know she was the one more beloved to Yaakov. Asher bonu shteim et beit Yisrael, both built the house of Israel. V'asei chayil befrata, do the right thing, do what is strong, what is correct in Ephrat. V'kros shem bebeit lechem, and her name will be called in Beit Lechem. And as I said, her name is now Rut mi Beit Lechem. V'ehi beit chaka beit Peretz, and now of course they throw in this whole allusion to the house of Peretz, which goes right back to the Yehud and Tamar story. We'll talk about this next week. Asher yolda Tamar Yudah, that Tamar had given birth to Yehuda. And you are continuing with the child that is coming from this young girl. And they got married, that's the 10 men. They sort of threw a Sheva Brocha straight away. And they had relations. And she had a child. And now the women. And of course it's so significant because these were the women who listened to her when she complained and they were there. Did they really give us support at the beginning? But now they're coming back. They're sort of doing their own teshuvah. And they're saying to Naomi, Baruch Hashem, Asher, and this is the language that we saw before, that Boaz was very much encouraging, blessing in the name of God. Asher lo ishbid lecha lach goel ayom, that there's no a lacking of a redeemer. Ve'ikoresh mo b'Yisrael, and the name will continue in Israel, the family name. Ve'yah lach lemeshiv nefesh, and this is going to be a meshiv nefesh, what the rabbis call tchiyat amitim, right? This idea of Gilgul, which I don't even want to go into, the idea of reincarnation, that the new neshama that's coming to this child will be from the people who died from Machlon and Kilim, in this case from Machlon. Ulechalkel et seivatech, and that he will support you in your old age. Kilekalatech asha ahevatech yiladato, your daughter-in-law has given birth to this child, Ashehito Vala, Mishiva banim. She's better for you than seven sons. In other words, she's looked after you in such a way, and now you're finally getting a bracha of this child. And what happened? Vatikach Naomi et hayeled vatishiseu b'cheika. Naomi sort of took the child into her lap. Vatilolo menet, and she started looking after the child. It says she became the nurse. Now it could be that there's a nace going on. I don't see anyone talking about it because Naomi is not young. And maybe she's feeding the child. It's not clear to me what's going on exactly, but this may very well be a sort of a siman again, min hashamayim, how incredible this whole story is. And again, and maybe I'll save this for next time because I want to say something about this. The name of the child, what will it be? Leimor yulad ben Naomi. A child has been born to Naomi, not to Ruth, interestingly, but it says to Naomi. And remember that Naomi was the one who said that I am with you, Ruth, in everything that you did in chapter 3. But Tikreno Shemo Oved, who Avi Yishai Avi David. And this guy is called Oved, who is the father of Yishai, the father of David. And then finally, this is the main reason, one of the reasons we read it on Shavuot, the Eile Todo Peretz, Peretz Olide Chetzron, from Peretz we go to Chetzron, Chetzron Olided Ram, Ram Olided Aminadav, Aminadav Olided Nachshon, went down to Nachshon, Nachshon holidet Salma, who is the man mentioned in the Megillah. There's a lot of years which are being covered here. I'm not going to go through it, but the Ibn Ezra works out all of the numbers. And it's really worth trying to struggle through the Ibn Ezra. He seems to suggest that all of these people had children very, very late in life. Because you're jumping here from the Yetziat Mitzrayim to David, and you've only got very small number of generations covering about 400 years. So he basically works out that all of these births were miraculous in their own right, because the people who had the babies were very old. And he says, V'salman holidet Boaz, Boaz holidet Oved, Boaz had a child called Oved, Oved holidet Yishai, Yishai holidet David, and Yishai has David. It's unbelievable story, this. It just is unreal, it's unbelievable. And as I said today, one of the great revelations over here, you know, is the rabbinic literature on this. And I just want to just point out to you, if you just turn over the page I gave you, and you look very quickly, this is the final word, section F, and I'm not going to go through it, but it's a bit of homework. The whole story of Ruth is alluded to. This is Rav Lipowitz, whose commentary, again, I'm so pleased that we've been able to look at some of what he said, because it's so beautiful what he wrote. And he says here, and he says you should look at Tehillim chapter 72. Tehillim 72, when you're sitting around Shabbos afternoon and you've got a few minutes, look at Tehillim 72, where it's David is davening for Shlomo. It's a beautiful Tehillim. And he says that through that Tehillim we see all the aspirations of the book of David are reflected, are reflected in David's words in Tehillim. And it's so beautiful what he says, that that David in fact makes this Tehillim so relevant to that particular discussion. In other words, in terms of the messianic process, and as I said, we'll talk a bit more maybe about that next week, just to mention some general comments. And I'm not going to go through it now, but the Tehillim 72 is beautiful. And if you put all this together, and there's so much more, as you can see from this page, that we can discuss, basically we've come to the sort of the climax of the whole thing, back to the big picture. And the big picture is the last couple of sentences. The last couple of sentences which take this very sort of almost mundane story, you know, sort of a slice of light from this very small group of people, and it becomes messianic. It doesn't just become messianic for them, it becomes messianic for us and for the whole world. Remarkable. And the pasuk that everybody quotes, and this is what I want to leave you with, is this famous pasuk, Olam Chesed Yibaneh. Olam, a world. The world, Chesed Yibaneh, is built through Chesed. That's the focus of this book. And the message is, the Musar is, I'm going to leave you to work it out for yourself, but the beauty of it is that from these small acts of kindness, from the small picture comes this fantastic, fantastic big picture of Mashiach and what Mashiach is about. And the process, as he says, if you look into Tehillim, Ayin Bet, you'll see at the end there, it tells you, you know, the whole idea is not just Mashiach for us, Mashiach for the whole world. Let's hope. Imhera b'yomeinu. Amen. Thank you, everybody.